Hello, ramblers and gamblers. Josh Rosenthal here. Thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing IG at Rambling and Gambling, and the old email, ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. Here's what we got cooking today. Your returning champ, Raheem Palmer of the Action Network, is back to talk NBA playoffs and a little bit of Canelo. Then Matt Metcalf is coming on. Matt is the sportsbook director at Circa Sports. It's like the one book that all the big-time gamblers, the sharps, really seem to respect. So why is that? And lastly, do you know how many miles your favorite NFL team is going to have to travel this year? Bill Spiros of bookies.com is going to fill you in. We're also talking a little Tom Brady and a little horse racing in that one, too. Without further ado, let's get things started with Raheem Palmer. Ra, welcome back to the pod, my man. Always a pleasure to have you on. Although, wait, can I still call you Ra? You know, you've been so big time here lately. What should I go with, Mr. Palmer? What are you thinking, man?
Oh, man, I'm never going to be Hollywood, man. Like, I'm still always Raheem, Ra, whatever you want to call me, but... Nah, you don't got to call me Mr. Palmer. I'm still young.
So just in case the listeners don't know why I'm doing this to Raheem here is because just in the past couple weeks, he appeared on one of the Ringer podcasts with Bill Simmons. It was amazing. I mean, Ry, you crushed it. I actually tailed a couple of your bets and made some money. You were really, really good. And then I texted you immediately because – Monday morning, as I always do, I was listening to the Bill Simmons podcast. It's a big Sunday episode that he does with Ryan Russillo. And just very casually, they were talking about the Canelo fight. And he's like, oh, yeah, Raheem Palmer texted me in the fourth round about Canelo going vegan for this fight. And that's when I got nervous. And I'm like, oh, my God. Like, it wasn't even like in some ways, that's even better than a pod appearance because it's just a casual name drop. It's just like, oh yeah, Raheem, you know, Raheem knew it was up. That was, I'm so happy for you, man. I'm so proud of you. That is so cool. And you've just been killing it.
Yo, thank you so much. You know, it's, it was so funny to me. I was just wondering how the vegan thing was going to impact Canelo. And obviously he was moving up in weight. And he just didn't have the stamina in that fight. So it probably did have some impact, but you know, Bill Simmons is my guy. He started following me on Twitter, say about a couple months ago, and we built, you know, good friendship. So it's truly a blessing to be shout out on such a big platform.
I'm going to bring Canelo up later in the interview at the end, just real quick. You know, I've said it before because I've been predicting a miraculous Raheem rise for quite some time. I've been as Bill Simmons would say, I have lots of Raheem stock. I've housed on Raheem Island. Just, you know, no matter how big you get, man, please. Please keep doing our pod. Parrish and I.
Oh, no, we're friends. You can call me anytime you want.
and you know I do. All right, here we go. I don't want to take up too much of your time today. We're going to do like 15 minutes, ideally. We'll see. Most of which is going to be NBA playoffs. Let's start big picture. Last time you were on, just before round one began, we talked about how betting Phoenix to win it all made a lot of sense. Well, since then, they had a little bit of trouble with the Pelicans. They've had a lot of trouble with Luka and the Mavs. And in fact, I believe most books now say the Warriors are the favorites to win it all, not the Suns. We're recording this Tuesday afternoon. So Phoenix-Dallas game 5 hasn't happened yet. That's tonight. But having said that, Ra, have you had a change of heart? Are the Suns still your pick to win it all?
Oh, I've had a drastic change of heart. It's a shame we haven't talked. Like I realized just how long we haven't spoke. It's probably been like a month, right? Because over the course of a month, I mean, like I've drastically changed. Like I've changed probably one game into the postseason. And one of the things that I think I neglected about this Suns team is that I actually don't think they have another gear from what we saw in the regular season. This is a team which takes part, like their perimeter oriented team with Devin Booker and Chris Paul. They take the majority of their shots from mid range. So they're first in mid range shooting frequencies. They're taking 41% of their shots from mid range. But despite being a perimeter oriented team, they were 25th in three-point frequency during the regular season. So, you know, the analytics movement says that the most efficient shots are three-pointers, well, mainly corner threes, dunks, layups, and foul shots. Well, the Phoenix Suns, they're not taking a large majority of threes. And even though they have DeAndre Ayton, they're not dominating inside. So against this Mavericks team, which doesn't really have traditional bigs, they're not dominating inside. And then they're being outscored from three. So you look at this Mavericks team. They're taking the highest percentage of threes in the postseason. They're shooting 47% of their field goal attempts from behind the arc. So you look at game four. They got outscored by 33 points from behind the arc. Now, I do think the Suns have an advantage because they have home court. They have home court in this series. But to me, if you ask me, I think either the Mavericks or the Warriors are going to put them out of the playoffs just because if you could slow down Devin Booker and Chris Paul and you could kind of outscore them from three, I'm not really that high on the Suns team anymore at all.
Do you have the Warriors winning it all now?
I don't have them winning it all, but I think it's the Mavericks or the Warriors out of the West. Like, I really think it's one of those two teams. I'm just not crazy about the Suns. I'm going to be honest with you. I think as far as the finals, I think this series between the Milwaukee Bucks and the Boston Celtics, I think that's the finals.
Yeah. I'm inclined to agree with that. Speaking of the Mavericks, Luka, he's just been insane. I mean, you surround Luka with real deal sharpshooters and magic things happen. He has been so good. It made me think, like, if you were going to start a playoff team from scratch, so contracts don't matter, age doesn't matter, health doesn't matter, who would you pick if you are drafting a team just for one playoff series right now?
I'm taking Giannis Antetokounmpo. I love Luka, but I mean, we saw his team win without him. And I think the big issue with Luka is that as great as he is offensively, as a scorer and a playmaker, he still doesn't necessarily have it together as a defender. And I think you're seeing that in this Suns series. Now, throughout the first couple of games of the series, the Suns were targeting Luka in the pick and roll. Now, I think his teammates have done a better job at recovering for him in games three and four. Like, I actually have the exact numbers for this. I think in game four, Doncic was defended as a screener just 18 times, according to Second Spectrum. So Devin Booker and Chris Paul weren't able to really take on him one-on-one like they did in the first couple of games of this series. So, like, they're attacking him in switches. And, look, when the Suns haven't been able to do that, they've had some problems. But when they have been, I mean, they've been successful. So I just think Giannis is the total overall package. Obviously, he does have some flaws in terms of not being able to make three-point shots. But he's the – like, as far as the star, to me – we saw him unlock another gear in the NBA Finals last year. So until proven otherwise, I think he's the best. He's the league's best player.
For this exercise, I think Giannis is pretty clearly the right answer. But it does start to get really interesting when you get to number two, if this were a draft. Because if Giannis is off the board, Luka's there. So is Steph Curry, who we just saw have an amazing fourth quarter, especially last night. KD. LeBron's still out there. Who would you have going second in this one, Raheem?
This is really hard. I'm gonna go with Nikola Jokic.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with Nikola Jokic
over Curry, over KD.
I think Curry is on the decline. I love him. He's like my favorite two players over since Kobe retired. Like, my favorite players growing up with Kobe and Iverson. My favorite two players in basketball were Steph Curry and Kyle Lowry. But I think Curry's on a decline. I mean, he still has the gravity, but he just doesn't. The thing with Curry, like, small guards tend to struggle. And look, Curry is the best small guard we've ever seen, but it's still a big man's game. And I think Nikola Jokic, look, the fact that they were even competitive in that series without Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr., it says how great he is. There's a reason he won back-to-back MVPs. And, you know, there's this campaign, I call it, among media members and fans, anybody but Jokic. Just because, I mean, when you look at Jokic's profile, he's not insanely athletic. His game isn't really aesthetically pleasing other than his passing. He doesn't overwhelm you with force like Embiid. He doesn't wow you with speed like John Morant, but he's put up some of the greatest seasons we've ever seen in NBA history. So the fact that they were competitive in that series without Michael Porter Jr. and Jamal Murray, it says it all. They won a series last year against the Blazers with no Jamal Murray. So this guy's one of the best players in the league. So I think Jokic is second by far.
I know I said I was going to keep this to 15 minutes and we're still going to be close, but you brought up your love of Kyle Lowry. Raheem, is Lowry approaching Larry Holmes status?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I love Kyle Lowry. This is my guy. I mean, actually, we're the same age. I think his birthday is about 4 or 5 days before. His birthday was the 25th of March or something like that. But it's just, I mean, when you're 36 years old, small guards tend to struggle in the postseason. I mean, right now, I don't want to call him fully Larry Holmes status. He is injured. He got a hamstring injury. It's pretty rough. But he's closer to the end than he is the start of his career.
One more Larry Holmes watch candidate here. What do you think about Klay right now? Klay Thompson.
Oh, Klay can still, I think Klay is going to be effective because he can shoot so well. But I think the biggest issue with Klay is that he tends to force a lot of shots. I mean, he still thinks he's Klay from 2-3 years ago. I mean, this is a guy off a torn ACL, a torn Achilles, and he can't defend in ways that he used to in the past. So he is on Larry Holmes' watch.
Raheem, he can't stay in front of anybody right
at
now.
At all. Yeah.
It's shocking to see. I know he's coming off these injuries. I hope he gets it back, which sometimes we see happen. I mean, he's coming off of several major leg injuries. But it's nuts. Klay Thompson cannot stay in front of anyone right now. Memphis is torching him.
It's very hard to watch. And I mean, look, I mean, Kevin Durant kind of defied all rules and everything that we see from injuries. But he just had one injury. He had an Achilles injury. Klay Thompson's been out almost 2.5-3 seasons now. So I don't know if he's ever going to get that back.
Do you have any bets or angles that you think better should be thinking about as the playoffs roll on? And keep in mind, again, Rod, you know, the pod's going to come out after the two Tuesday night game fives that we have tonight.
Yeah, I think one of the angles that me and my coworker, Matt Moore, we've been always playing. You should actually get him on here, too. He's like probably one of the most prominent NBA writers ever. But we've been taking the loser of the Celtics-Bucks series because we think whoever wins this series is going to win the NBA title. So, say the Bucks lost last night, it's a good time to get Bucks futures.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So it would be like you would take like the Bucks to win it all type of thing.
Yeah, just because you can get such good value on them after a loss. Like, I think what are the Bucks to win an NBA title right now? The Bucks are at FanDuel right now. They're plus 750.
Yeah.
That's insane. And they granted, they're 5.5-point underdogs, but even the Celtics at plus 410, because I truly believe that whoever wins this series is going to win the next series against the Heat or the Sixers. So I think you got some good value there.
All right, let's do a little bit of Canelo. This was nuts, right? I mean, Canelo, regarded by many, probably most, is the pound-for-pound king. I think he was like minus 550. What's your take on this fight, Ra?
Look, I mean, I think he just bit off a little bit more than he can chew. Look, they have weight classes for a reason. And look, Canelo Alvarez, he's a great fighter. He was Ring Magazine's pound for pound number one best fighter in the sport. But I think he's always struggled with fighters who have some movement. They're slick. They can box. They have a solid jab. Like, I mean, you look at the guys he's fought, Caleb Plant. You look at Billy Joe Saunders. If they could move, they can cause some problems for a while. And I think not only could this guy do that in Bevo, he could do that, but he was bigger and he could take Canelo's best shot. Like, actually, this is so interesting. Right before the pandemic, Canelo actually fought Kovalev, and I actually went to that fight because I was blessed. I did some music for Bernard Hopkins' camp for one of his fights. And I happened to be out in Vegas at the time, and I realized it was a Canelo fight, and the guy gave me free tickets. So I went to the fight, and Kovalev, who isn't really the best boxer, he was a guy who's mostly known for knocking guys out, but this is an older version of Kovalev. He actually, to me, he was winning that fight at the time he got stopped in the 10th or 11th round. So, I mean, the judges didn't see it that way, but if you can outbox Canelo and you could take his best shot, then Canelo kind of doesn't have much for you. And I think we saw that in this fight, and with Canelo going up in weight class, look, I mean, it's hard to stop a guy and hard for that power to translate as you go up. And the one thing the guy said was, look, Canelo couldn't hit me. He was mostly hitting me on my arms. And when he did hit me, I wasn't affected. So the thing with Canelo is, like, if he doesn't respect your puncher power, he's going to walk right through you. And he couldn't do that to this guy. So it was probably a bad matchup, but you got to give credit to Canelo Alvarez because he dared to be great. And that's something that a lot of boxers aren't doing.
Parrish, noted boxing fan, you want in on this one?
I agree with my man Ra. I think, the thing about Canelo is, and he's right, like, Canelo has to be, he can't hit a moving target. He has very difficulty moving, hitting targets. So if you're slick, like Bivol, he's pretty slick. If you're slick like Mayweather, like, you know, he has a hard time hitting those type of fighters. And, you know, when he beat Kovalev, you're right, he's also right. Kovalev, you know, he was tailor-made for Canelo. He stood in front of you, he had power, but Kovalev was not slick. He wasn't a slick boxer. You know, but you have to give it to Canelo, too, because at the same time, he went up in weight and he wanted to be great. And so you can't knock him for that. However, he has to come back down in weight and fight Charlo. He has to fight Benavidez. Like, there are fights for him at 166 that he can fight. Even at 160, possibly, too. And those are bigger fights to me than Bivol. But I think he thought that Bivol was going to be a better fight for him or easier. So he took that fight. Also, he has to fight Triple G for the trilogy. The third fight has to be made. I think he's been ducking Triple G for a long time now. So, you know, he's a great fighter, right? He might be one of the best Mexican fighters out there. Maybe better than Chavez, I'm not sure. But a few more years, we'll know if he's better than, you know, than Chavez, possibly. But, you know, I applaud him for going up in weight and trying to, you know, to for another belt.
The one thing I will say, though, the frustrating thing about, and I'm Parrish, I wonder if you feel the same. It feels like Canelo is on this European tour where he doesn't want to fight the American fighters out there. And he's just going over to Europe and kind of beating these guys who don't have a lot of movement to them and feeling like he can walk through them. And I just feel like they've had such careful matchmaking that it's frustrating for me because I would like to see him fight like a guy like Charlo or a guy like Andre. Also, the one thing that's tough about Canelo fights, it's very difficult to bet against him. Like, as we saw in that fight, one of the scorecards were 115, 113. So if Bivol, who was obviously winning the fight, if he just said, look, I'm going to take off the 12th round. I'm not going to risk a stop. I'm not going to risk, you know, losing this fight in a 12th round knockout. That would have been a draw. So I don't want to say boxing is sport, it's fixed, but we all know it's a corrupt sport in which sometimes there's a judge on one team's camp. I mean, we saw Canelo Alvarez get dominated by Floyd Mayweather, and CJ Ross said Canelo won the fight. So it's very tough to bet against Canelo in Vegas because you got to win overwhelmingly to get a decision.
Yeah, you know, Canelo is the cash cow. Similar to Mayweather, you had to, like, if Mayweather lost, that's bad for boxing, right? Because it's bad for money. So you had to really beat the champion, you know, to win. Otherwise, you wouldn't get the decision because, you know, money would be lost, you know, down the line. And right now, Canelo is the cash cow, just like Mayweather was a cash cow. Roy Jones was a cash cow. And so, you know, you have to beat the champ, really beat him convincingly, you know, to win.
Does everybody have Terrence Crawford as the pound-for-pound king now?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
I do, but no, I actually don't. Errol Spence, to me, is the pound-for-pound king. I'm not sure why he's number four, but he should be number one, maybe because of the car accident, potentially. But Errol Spence has been dominating. In this last fight with Ugas, I mean, he crushed Ugas.
Oh, yeah, he did.
He crushed Ugas. Ugas, he may never fight again. So it's possible that, you know, like, I don't know why he's not number one. Oh, at least now number two, you know, if not number one.
You know what? I think you're right. But you know what, though? I think Crawford is getting some props because he stopped Sean Porter. I think that's probably why he's so high up there. But like you said, Spence was just, I mean, he's dominated everybody. I mean, that performance against Ugas was like something else.
Yeah, and I just wonder if that was Spence's best, which I think it probably was. I wonder if Crawford's best can beat Spence's best.
I think it's interesting because Ugas actually got off against Spence in that fight. And I think if Terrence Crawford was in that same position, Errol Spence would have got stopped. Like, we saw him get hurt.
Yeah, he did get hurt. Yeah. He got stunned. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We'll see, man. We'll see. That's going to be a super fight. And, you know, when that fight comes around, man, I can't wait for it. I couldn't wait. You know, 2 years, I wanted to see this fight 2 years ago.
Yeah, we all been waiting for it. I think this fight and then Deontay Wilder versus Anthony Joshua were the two most anticipated fights that we wanted to see and we haven't seen.
This is fantastic. A huge smile on my face. Just for the listeners, so you know, I've mentioned Parrish quite a few times. Parrish is the producer of this podcast. Parrish is also the photographer who I work with every single day on TV for Fox 5 DC. We've worked together for years. For years, I've tried to get Parrish to come on the podcast. I have tried to get Parrish to go on TV a couple of times. Never does it. Actually did it once before when we had Raheem on last time and we were talking boxing, but we screwed up the audio. So I'm confident we got it right this time. This is actually going to be Parrish's debut. That was great, man. And we got to get you on more, Parrish. You got a knack for this.
Yeah, Parrish, you're good, man. Like, use your talent. Use your talent, man.
I know.
Boxing is the one sport that I love, man. So, you know, when it comes to boxing, like all day, this is nothing to me.
Well, this was great. I didn't quite keep to my 15-minute promise there, Raheem, but we were closer than usual. Mr. Palmer, should I say, where can people find you? Anything you want to plug?
You can find me on Twitter. I am Rostradamus. You can find me at the Action Network. I have articles. You can find me on any podcast feed, the Buckets feed, the Action Network feed. I have a huge announcement coming up soon. We'll announce it probably, what is it? End of May, you'll see. I already told Josh, so he knows. So you'll be hearing about it. So
I cannot wait to get into it publicly, my man. Raheem Palmer, Action Network, New York Post, best bud of Bill Simmons, and of course, first ballot Rambling and Gambling Hall of Famer, as we always say. You're awesome, Parrish. You're awesome too. Thank you both. Joining me now, Matt Metcalf, sportsbook director at Circus Sports in fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada. Great to have you on the Rambling and Gambling pod, Matt. I'm really glad that we can make this work.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Josh.
I'm so interested in hearing what you have to say, in large part because you are a bookmaker at a place that all the real deal sharp gamblers seem to really respect. Before we get to that, though, let's start here. Really simple. What is a bookmaker? I know you have other responsibilities too, but what does a bookmaker do?
I mean, essentially a bookmaker is somebody who hangs a market, which could be, you know, a college baseball game or the Super Bowl, and then takes two-way action on that market. And, you know, the goal is to write action and write bets back and forth and earn your money off of the commission or the juice or the vig or whatever you want to call it. But a good bookmaker writes bets and earns money.
You set the line and adjust accordingly.
Yeah. And, you know, it's an interesting distinction that I sometimes make. There's an odds maker who isn't always a bookmaker. You had very famous odds makers throughout history. You know, Roxy Roxborough was one of them who had a company that set the lines and didn't necessarily, you know, take the action. So just because you're an odds maker doesn't necessarily make you a bookmaker. Just because you're a bookmaker, you don't need to be a great odds maker. I think it helps, but, you know, some of the best bookmakers in the world probably would tell you, you know, I can't make a number. I open a number and then I learn off my customers and I see where the number should be, but you know, it's not my job to set the number. So I think it helps, but yeah, not all bookmakers are odds makers for sure.
It seems to me that one of the main things that sets Circa apart from other books is that you guys set standard limits that apply to everybody, including winning bettors who we've seen be severely limited when betting elsewhere. Do you agree with that? Is that one of the main draws of Circa?
Yeah, I think so. The staple of Circa to me is consistency, and whether that's through our limits or our service or, you know, I guess when we hang lines, I've tried to create what was born out of frustration for me as a professional bettor, a lack of consistency in the sports betting space, where you would go into a given sports book and be there to bet golf. And, you know, the two Mondays before at 10 a.m., they hung the number. And then you come in at Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. and there's no numbers on the board. And you say, hey, where's the golf? Oh, we're going to get to it this afternoon. Or you go in to place a bet on Tiger Woods and the limit's, you know, 300 one day and then 1,000 the next day. And so everything in the sports betting space is just begging for some, you know, consistent, just standards, minimum standards, I guess, for everything. So that was born out of my own frustration. And when we started Circus Sports, I wanted to try to be as consistent as we could throughout, you know, all aspects of our business.
I want to play a clip from when we had noted pro bettor Spanky on the pod back in September. I think this gets into what you're saying a little bit. Here's Spanky.
So it becomes a cat and mouse game. It's a shame that's the case because that's not always been the case But unfortunately, in today's environment, you know, it's a cat and mouse game between professional sports bettor and what I call not bookmakers, but dressmakers, guys that don't understand the art of bookmaking, and they don't have the talent to be able to utilize sharp action to their advantage.
And Matt, it sounds like you probably qualify as a bookmaker, not a dressmaker.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm probably quick to make excuses for a lot of people who don't take action. I think that technology has dealt them a bad hand in a lot of times in terms of, you know, opening up shop. And the thing we have to remember with like DraftKings and FanDuel is they're operating at scale. And, you know, while I can make a mistake and open a bad number and have a limit of 1,000 and maybe only take $10,000 in liability, you know, if these guys did the same thing, they might be sitting on $1 million in liability. So it's a little bit of a difficult game that they're playing, and I can appreciate that. But at the same time, you know, I wouldn't be in this business if we couldn't take bets and operate the way I believe it should be. And I think it comes down to this other point where a lot of people involved in sports betting, you know, view this as an entertainment product that people should be placing, you know, relatively low wagers on. And then you have a whole other subset of people who view this as, you know, this is a financial type market and, you know, using this as an investment tool. And I understand the points of the recreational proponents and who say this is not meant to be an investment tool. But then again, you know, where I come from and how I grew up, sports betting, the goal was always to make money. And what's the goal of any investment? To make money. So I don't really see why it has to be any different from any other market. And I think the more transparency we can add, the more people can interact with our product however they choose to, whether that's for entertainment or whether that's as a financial instrument. I'm not here to dictate how you should bet at Circa Sports and what your reasons for betting are. I'm here to try to give you the largest wager I'm capable of accepting and providing you a service from that regard. And I would never tell you like, no, don't bet that much. That's, you know, this should only be for fun, or, hey, you should be having fun. You know, like, it feels insincere to me. Like, good products to me, they're set up with, you know, any user can come and interact with them and they don't have to disclose their reason for using them or disclose, you know, why they chose to bet at Circa Sports. They're betting there because they want to. And honestly, that's your business. Bet with us because, you know, for any reason you want, I'm just happy to have your business.
Can you explain how you use bets from sharps like Spanky, for instance, to your advantage and use it, you know, to help shape your lines?
Yeah, I think, you know, the way we book lines at Circa, we book bets, you know, we have a kind of a tiered approach in our limits. We start out early, let's say college football, you know, we open the number for 3,000 or 2,000 on the side. I can't remember what we took last year. You know, that's the limit on Sunday when we open. First college football opener in the world. There's my plug. Monday morning.
I'm gonna bring it up later. I'm gonna ask you about that later. Keep going.
Monday morning, we bumped to 10 or 20,000. The whole point of this is kind of a price discovery process where we're paying the bettors to kind of tell us what the number should be, because we recognize that the bettors are much, you know, better than us at setting these lines. So yeah, on Sunday we take some bets, we move the line around a little. A lot of the bettors will wait till Monday when the limits open up a little and they can get 10 or 20,000. Some of the bettors are still waiting and say, you know what, it's not worth my time to give my information to the market until I'm getting 50,000 a bet. So those bettors we see come in Thursday or Friday when the limits bump to 50. And then there's some yet that, you know, don't want their information to be out there till right before the game and when we're taking the highest limits. So they'll say, okay, I'm gonna wait till Saturday, 20 minutes before the game goes, and then I'm at about 100,000 or 200,000 at Circa Sports. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of how we set this tiered approach where we can deal with what I believe bets from everybody. We couldn't open the gates and just say $100,000 or $500,000 on any game from anybody. You know, there is strategy behind it, and that's how we're able to deal with it. But we utilize that information, and we try to make our lines sharper so that later in the week, you know, we feel like we have a really good number on the board, where if somebody walks up and, you know, wants to bet a very large amount, we feel very confident that we've seen enough bets that we can take a bet and feel like we're not getting, you know, the worst of it necessarily. We're able to earn off that bet, and we have a good chance, and the vig can work for us in that situation.
You mentioned how liability can be very different for some of these, you know, high volume books, a DraftKings or a FanDuel. Do you think that's the main reason that most of these books don't operate like Circa does in terms of taking sharp action and using it to your advantage?
I think the technology is a big part. I think that they are hampered by that, but I think there's just a general belief, and you know, a lot of these companies, I don't want to say the companies themselves originate in the European or the Australian markets, but the people running the risk for them often originate in other countries. And, you know, I think it's just a different environment. And I don't think you can compare what sports betting is in Europe or what sports betting is in Australia to what it is in the US. And I think there's definitely more of an appetite for risk, and it's more culturally accepted to bet large amounts of money here. I believe. I mean, I could be speaking a little out of turn. I haven't been to Australia. I don't entirely know, but I do know how it is in the U.S. And I do know that, you know, wagering large amounts of money is acceptable here, and people do it for a variety of reasons. But I do think there's also a lack of commitment to, you know, hiring people who are able to do the job to manage risk. Because when you get down to it, anybody who's managing risk at a high level in our room is good enough to be a professional sports bettor. And, you know, at this point in the game, with all the accounts that are, or all the companies that have opened up, most professional sports bettors, you know, can make, you know, anywhere from 100 to 500,000 a year, you know, not even getting into Billy Walters territory. I mean, there's just a lot of money available there. So you really, to get the best people to come work for you that can handle large wagers, you have to commit to paying them. And, you know, that can be a challenging thing, I guess, for companies to say, hey, before we even start, we're going to have to commit, you know, 250,000 to 10 different employees to really get our risk room going. Yeah, it's a lot of overhead, and they think they can do it cheaper and more effectively. And, you know, I understand why they think that, but in my end, volume is always going to trump everything else. And you get to a point where, you know, the wise guy bets, you know, while they matter in a sense that you're setting the line with them and these are winning players, you know, they don't necessarily, they're not going to decide your bottom line if you write enough. And so that's kind of the direction we're going. And it's kind of a hard battle to start with, because we really have to take our lumps when we start out. And, you know, we got to put the cart ahead of the horse. We got to take bigger limits. But my thought is, you know, year 3, 4, 5, when we actually do start accumulating more of a just a more kind of wide ranging clientele, I think we'll have a really healthy business model.
You've been on both sides of the counter. You were with a book, you became a pro bettor for 8 years, I believe a successful one. And then you came back because you got this, you know, great offer to kind of open things up with Circa. Can you tell me about betting NASCAR when you were a pro bettor? Because I think like you kind of had like an angle here that was very successful, right? How'd that come about?
Yeah, I think, you know, I found my early success concentrating on markets that were less paid attention to by bookmakers. And I think a lot of professional sports bettors start that way. I moved out here in 2003. I didn't believe that professional sports betting was possible when I moved out here. And this is coming from somebody who had paid a lot of attention to gambling and sports betting. I just didn't think it was a thing. I thought, you know, you just have to get too lucky. I came out here and I immediately got a job at the Imperial Palace working for Jay Cornegay and saw successful professional sports bettors and just opened my eyes. And I'm like, okay, this is a thing. And, you know, I was a kid at the time and I didn't know anything. And so I started paying attention and I'm like, all right, these guys are winning in these different sports. You know, and I think I understood at that point that it was more about information than it necessarily was about just picking winners and losers, and a lot, you know, about price. So I kind of stumbled upon NASCAR with a buddy of mine, where we found a paywall on the NASCAR website that if you paid $5 a month, you could see the speeds from the practice sessions. And I knew nothing about NASCAR. I had never watched a NASCAR race in my life. I probably had made fun of NASCAR my entire life, being from Florida, to anybody who watched it. But we saw these speeds and we're looking at them and we're going, okay, well, they're practicing for Sunday's race. It's Friday. Jeff Gordon is going, you know, 160 miles an hour. And, you know, Dale Earnhardt is going 155 miles an hour. So he's 5 miles an hour faster than them. The track is only, you know, a mile and a quarter long. You know, it's not going to take very long for him to kind of pass this guy and be multiple laps up on him. So we thought we had some, but we're like, it can't be this easy. Like anything, we decided, you know, it's easier to kind of watch something if you put your own money on it, you pay more attention. So we started betting these matchups. I think the first week, I think we went like 13-1, and we're just like, okay, maybe it is this easy. So we just started, we kept doing that for a couple of years. And I just kept betting and kept kind of building my bankroll to the point where, you know, I was doing pretty good. And I was like, hey, I think I can make more money doing this than I can, you know, working at the book. I didn't really want to quit the book, but it was just a matter of hours. And I was devoting too many hours to working in the sports book and not enough hours to betting on NASCAR. And I was making more money betting the NASCAR. So yeah, that's kind of how I got started doing that. And, you know, when I quit in 2010, I remember that was my first losing NASCAR season. And I realized, like, I'm winging this way too much. At that point, I knew I needed a better methodology, a better approach. And so I kind of got into, you know, once I quit, I had some time to think, and I came up with a very rudimentary kind of Excel sheet that just allowed me to kind of, you know, put my thoughts down to paper and standardize my process a lot better. And things from there got much better. And it wasn't as easy. Other people were betting it by then, but my process was better. And so it allowed me to win. And from there, I started making college football numbers, college basketball numbers, and I had a decent success at more so college football than college basketball. But yeah, I think you can take an approach betting any sport and, you know, kind of move it over to how you approach, you know, a different sport. It's just a matter of the edges might not be as big. So the edge in NASCAR at the time when I was betting was huge. And, you know, the edge in other sports is basketball was probably much, much smaller to that regard. But, you know, you find a lot of people who don't want to operate in these smaller markets. They want to bet big money. And so if you want to bet big money, you go to the bigger markets, you bet, and you have a less of an edge, but you can get more down. And so kind of just depends what you're looking to do.
Awesome. I love that story. I'd heard you tell it before, but I was like, I got to retell that one. For college football, we talked about it. Circa sets literally the first weekly line every Sunday during the season. First line that goes up in the world, which is like, to me, it blows my mind. I just think it's so unfathomably ballsy. Can you explain how you set that line, what you take into account? And just for the listeners, so the listeners know, this line gets set, and then there are books all over the world that take a look at, okay, this is where Circa set it, and then they operate off of that accordingly. Go ahead, take it away, Matt.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have power ratings. Anyone who helps me with the numbers, my power ratings go back, like I said, probably 10, 12 years where I've just always made numbers. I just update my numbers from week to week. You know, I go through the games, I look through the box scores, I try to kind of like take out anything that is too kind of fluky, for lack of a better word, out of the box score, whether it's a turnover or, you know, just a star player being hurt. I'm just trying to kind of normalize for that stuff and get it out of the number and just have kind of a pure rating. And, you know, I plug my numbers in and see what it spits out. And then I kind of read what I can read about that week's game and see if there's any additional injuries or anything else that isn't in the box score that I can kind of factor in. And then, you know, have a number, and then two or three other guys will send me their number, and we'll kind of put them all together. We'll talk about it a little, and then we hang the first number. And, you know, it's not as scary of a process. And, you know, I really don't put a lot of stock in the opener. We missed numbers by 10 points on a college football opener. You know, we missed them by more in other sports. You know, as long as you know how to kind of book, this is where the odds making, the bookmaking mean. So, you know, you're an odds maker at this point. You have your odds making hat on, you hang a number, you know, I don't know, Alabama minus 40 versus Buffalo or something. And then the bets start to come in and they're taking, you know, plus 40, plus 39, plus 38. I mean, the skill in that point is a bookmaking skill with, you know, do I move this first bet plus 40 to plus 37? Do I move it to 39? Am I like that? That's where it really comes in, the skill of a good bookmaker, because the goal is to find the number as quickly as possible that kind of generates that two-way action where you feel like, okay, I'm in the window here of like what this number is. And then you can raise the limit. And then you kind of see some more bets and you feel like you're in the window. The window's a little tighter, raise the limit again. So, I mean, it's not overly scary. We'll miss numbers. We miss them all the time. It's good publicity, honestly, when we do. I think people enjoy seeing like Circa opens the spread, you know, 30, and then the number closes 20. People like that stuff. So,
all right, I can see that. That's a good point. I like that. All right, let's go home with this one. We're wrapping it up. You pick one of these options. Either give me your best advice for casual gamblers, or if you really want to make the listeners happy, but I don't want to push you to do this, give me a Vegas story, anything, just something that'll make us say, huh. With the Vegas guys, I typically ask that one, and it tends to be a hit with the listeners. But it's up
to
you.
I'm not good with Vegas stories. I'll tell you, I mean, my tip for somebody looking to bet sports, you know, in a winning manner is always look for a sport A that you have interest in, but also then ask yourself, what is the most, you know, the smallest, most niche market that I have a lot of knowledge in? Because there's a good chance you'll have more knowledge than the odds maker, than the algorithm that's spitting out those numbers. So, you know, you look into, you know, golf first round scores. If you're somebody who lives and breathes golf and you know the courses really well and you understand the players and you kind of know maybe first round tendencies or something, you know, there's probably an opportunity for you to make some winning bets in there. So I think you can always expand out of the lessons you learn in those markets. So whether it's NASCAR, you know, you learn a lot about money management, you learn about how to kind of like, you know, because betting is an art unto itself, how to actually make the bets, how to decide how much to bet. So a lot of those lessons you'll learn in markets where, you know, the edge is more on your side or not as big for the book. And, you know, you can learn these lessons cheap and then move on to bigger markets as you get better. But yeah, I mean, that's my thing is you don't need to don't feel pressure to start with NFL sides. I mean, that's not realistic. Start with NFL props on your favorite team. You know, the Dolphins, start with the Dolphins and do player props just on the Dolphins. Cause you know, these guys inside and out, and you know whenever they play the Bills, you know, this is how they're going to strategize and this is the kind of game plan they'll have. And I can use that towards my knowledge of the over under on the running back props. Like, that's the kind of stuff where you're going to really going to make a, you know, have a chance.
Well, if we're lucky enough to get you to come back on, Matt, we'll have to talk Gainesville next time. That's, I'm leaving that on the cutting room floor. I did not go to UF, as I know you did. However, my first job was at the ABC affiliate doing TV news in Gainesville. Oh, nice. I was there during the Tebow era, which was like a really good time to be there.
It's awesome.
So yeah, I've got thoughts. We can chat. Anyway, man, anything else you want to get out there? Anything you want to plug away?
No, I mean, we just launched in Illinois. Excuse me. We just announced our intention to launch in Illinois sometime this fall. Really excited. The American Place Casino, I think, is the casino we're partnering up with there. It'll be our first retail operation outside of Nevada. So I'm really excited for that. I'm really just, you know, I think that we do a good job of running a sports book, you know, the way I think that it should be run in terms of welcoming everybody and just creating an atmosphere that's exciting. And Derek Stevens and Mike Palm have really done a good job in kind of creating that reputation for us. And Jeff Benson, who runs all the books, just they're the best at their crafts. And yeah, I'm excited to be in Illinois. We're also currently in Iowa and Colorado. And yeah, if you're in Nevada, come visit the biggest sports book in the world, downtown Las Vegas. But other than that, thank you for having me. Enjoy the discussion.
Matt Metcalf, sportsbook director at Circus Sports. You're the man. Appreciate it. All right. Last but certainly not least, Bill Spiros, a senior betting analyst for bookies.com and also a sports columnist for the Boston Herald. Bill, let's start there real quick. I know you wrote a column today about my new colleague, Tom Brady, joining Fox Sports for quite a few bucks every year whenever he's done playing. Is that right?
Yeah. So what would that be, about a 2096? I think it'll be by the time he's on Fox Sports, it'll be like, you know, you'll be watching the games on your watches and the screen inside your head. There won't be any more television.
Just because he's going to play forever.
Yeah. I said in my column for tomorrow that he's eventually going to quit to spend more time with his great grandchildren.
Do you think, let me ask you this, and I want to get into the other stuff because I don't want to take up too much of your time. Bill, for the listeners, by the way, he's pulled over in his car. He's on the road driving to see the Red Sox play in Atlanta. Bill, do you think
that's payback for General Sherman, by the way. The Red Sox will get annihilated, I'm sure, and I'm only driving 400 miles to see it.
Do you think Brady is going to be a good play-by-play, or I guess he's the color guy whenever the time does come?
Well, he has the potential to be, but he hasn't shown it yet. You know, he always talks about loving the haters, and if you listen to him after every game, he's very particular about choosing his words, and he's never, ever critical of anyone but himself. He'll talk in generalities about the team struggling, but he'll never point out another player on television or in the press situation after a game. He'll do it during the game. You know, you watch the NFL films and every other word is bleep and bloop. But, you know, when he's in that media setting, he is all Mr., you know, rainbows and everybody's good. And so it is going to be a challenge for him, for his personality, to be able to be critical and analytical. And, you know, I, for one, am dying to see Tom Brady unleashed calling a Patriots game with an aged Bill Belichick making multiple mistakes.
Hey, man, fingers crossed that it happens, because that could be very entertaining. So anyway, here's why I reached out to you originally. Read an article that you published last week, really blew up, got a ton of attention, in part because Adam Schefter tweeted about it. But basically, you went ahead and figured out how many miles each NFL team will have to travel this season. And while some of it isn't exactly shocking, for instance, the Seahawks are going to travel the most miles, I really enjoyed the way that you laid it all out. For instance, you know that the Seahawks will travel about 30,000 miles on their 8 road trips, which means they will cross 34 time zones and travel more miles than it takes to go around the world. Give me some other highlights. I guess let's start here. I believe there are 4 other teams that will also travel more than all the way around the world, right?
Yeah, and the interesting one on that one is the Dolphins, because the Dolphins do not have an international game. They're going to log about 25,000 miles, and a lot of it is in the eastern. They have one long trip to the West Coast, but most of their trips are, you know, within the division, Buffalo, New York, and New England. That's probably 2,000, 2,500 miles each round trip. So the Dolphins are interesting in the fact that they log a lot of miles but don't leave the country and don't really traverse a lot of time zones. And of course, on the flip side, you have the Pittsburgh Steelers, who are not leaving the Eastern time zone at all this season, and they're only covering 6,400 miles. That's about 21% of what the Seahawks are doing. And the interesting part about when Adam shared my story, I used to work with him in Denver, so we've been connected and known each other for a while. When Adam shared my story, there was like an inter-scene civil war that broke out on the Twitter feed between Steelers fans who believe that, you know, they were finally given their righteous due, and Steelers haters who believe that the NFL is perpetually rigged for them. So that was a nice little commentary side running chat amongst the chat.
I was really surprised to see that the Steelers never leave the Eastern time zone. Another thing I liked, the shortest road trip of the season, Bill, you wrote, was 0 miles. Why is that?
The Rams will be playing the Chargers at SoFi. And since they both use the stadium at home, I assume they're not even going to change locker rooms. I would imagine there's a third locker room there for the visitors. And so, yeah, they don't even have to change locker rooms.
Longest. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. Longest trip. It's going to be Seahawks. They've got a game in Germany, in Munich, this year.
And the interesting part about that is, you know, you would expect perhaps that they might have a game in New York and then, you know, spend some time in New York and then go to Europe. But the closest game they have to Munich is Detroit. So, you know, even depending on how the schedule works, they're most likely going to have to leave and come back to Seattle. Now, I would assume it'll be after the bye to give them a break on the travel front. But still, they don't really catch a break at all.
One more team I'll mention, because this podcast is based in D.C. We got a lot of Commanders fans. They will travel the 25th most miles, according to Bill, coming in at 13,670 miles traveled. Not bad. Bill, you've been covering the league forever. How big of a difference do you think this will make?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, every year it changes, right? You know, one year the AFC East will play the NFC West, and one year the NFC East will play the AFC West. So sometimes, you know, you have built in, you know, you'll have a time where the Commanders or the Ravens will go to the West Coast maybe twice. This year you have 5 international games, and you also have a 17-game schedule. So I would assume the NFL is going to work to mitigate that. I think it could be a plus. It could be a minus. For instance, contrast the Steelers. You know, they have a bus trip to Cleveland every year. They take the bus. I looked that up. So you could say that's an advantage because they don't have to travel. You could say that's a disadvantage because they don't have the time away together that a team on the road like the Seahawks or the Broncos or the Dolphins might. And as we know in the NFL, oftentimes when a team is away together, that's much more important from a bonding and a chemistry perspective. So I don't know if there's an advantage or a disadvantage, but I would say that it's maybe equal, save for the time zone changes themselves. To me, I thought that was far more interesting than the distance.
Before I hit one last topic with you, Bill, any other, anything else with the NFL traveling that interested you that you want to throw out there?
Well, you know, I had never seen this done. You know, I've been covering the league in a professional manner one way or another for 30 years. And I had never seen this done. I'd never seen the miles logged. So, you know, this was an instance where the data wrote the story. I didn't have any preconceived notions when I started doing this. And I did the math about, I would say a month ago, I did most of the calculations. And then I made the adjustments when the international games were announced. So it was about a month ago when I realized the disparity between teams like Seattle, Denver, Miami, and teams like Detroit, Baltimore, and Pittsburgh. So that struck me as, hey, this is something. This isn't just data, you know, doing a bunch of fourth grade math questions. This is really something of interest. And, you know, based on the reaction the story got, not just from Adam, but, you know, it was picked up. You know, these people chart these things for us, and we've had 60 different websites pick it up so far. So, you know, there was obviously an interest in it. And I think what caught Adam's eye is that he had never seen it either. And, you know, the disparity as well. You know, the NFL preaches parity in scheduling. It preaches parity in terms of how they work the draft. Roger Goodell wants a different Super Bowl champion every year, especially if it's not the Patriots or Tom Brady. And yet here we have something as rudimentary and basic as the schedule that is as inequitable as anything the league has.
Yeah. I thought it was a great idea. I hope you keep doing this, Colin. This is really good. Here's the last thing I wanted to hit you with. I know you play the ponies a little bit too. Rich Strike, a 80-1 underdog, wins the Derby. Any chance we see the horse in the winner's circle again in the Preakness? I believe he's like 5-1. So it was the opener with him.
Yeah, well, what we saw in the Derby, you know, I think it's had 14 million views now, the bird's eye view of his rush. You know, what you saw in that race, the first quarter mile set a record. So it was 45 seconds. So the horses were gassed. And his jockey wisely held him back, knew the horse had a lot of late race strength, a lot of late race, you know, energy, if you will, or stamina. And, you know, he guided him through those other horses, and they were figuratively and literally standing still when he did it. The Preakness is shorter, of course, than the Derby. And I think what you're going to see is a slower pace because of that. You know, from Epicenter and Zandon and some of the other Derby favorites that got gassed because they just went out too fast. I'm not so sure about his chances in the Preakness just because of the length of the race, but he is well suited for the Belmont. You know, that is a race where many a great horse has sucked a lot of wind. I just charted it out yesterday. There have been 23 horses that have won the Preakness and Kentucky Derby that did not win the Belmont. So it's not really that unusual for a horse to win the first two legs of the Triple Crown. It's much more unusual for it to finish off because the Belmont is so long in comparison to these other races.
Good stuff. Bill, really appreciate it. I feel like we are just kind of scratching the surface with you with this conversation. This is the first time I've met Bill. I would love to have you back on. You cover a ton of stuff, and I like the way you do it.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm always happy to join you. You know, hopefully I won't be doing it from Bug Tussle. you know, I think I see the Petticoat Junction Hotel over there, and Barney Fife's probably going to pull me over for talking on the phone or something. But yeah, when I'm back in civilization or Florida, which is, I don't know if that's civilization. Yeah, anytime, of course.
Look forward to it. And just so the listeners know, Bill is pulled over talking to us. He's not
driving. I am safe. I am in a parking lot.
You know, people get sensitive over this stuff, Bill. We got to.
Yeah. It is a BP Church's chicken, which is an interesting combination. Eat here and get gas, I guess, is the old joke. And that holds true at the BP and Church's chicken.
Phil Spiros, bookies.com, Boston Herald. This is great. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
There it is, ladies and gents. Thanks to Raheem, Matt, Bill, and Parrish. We'll be back next Wednesday planning on having somebody talk about PGA Championship picks. I'm pretty sure Joe House is going to come back on and do that with us, which is awesome. People love Joe House's first appearance on the pod. Also, this should be fun. We're going to talk to the guy behind the awesome Twitter feed, Super 70s Sports. Check that one out if you don't know it. Super 70s Sports. Basically, anytime I get stuck on like one Twitter feed for 30 to 60 minutes, I figure it's worth inviting the person on. Otherwise, as I always say, thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing IG at Rambling and Gambling, and email me at ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. Ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. I've said it enough. You get the email. Everybody, have a great week.